Tonight on Coast to Coast, you're going to hear two distinctive subjects that somehow come back to each other eventually. First and foremost, this hour. United Airlines Flight 232, some of you may remember this, was on a scheduled flight from Stapleton International Airport in Denver, Colorado, to O'Hare's International Airport in Chicago. That was in 1989. The DC-10 crash-landed in Sioux City, Iowa, after suffering catastrophic failure of its tail-mounted engine, which led to the loss of all flight controls. Of the 296 people on board, 111 died in the accident. 185 survived. Now, despite the deaths, the accident is considered a prime example of successful crew resource management due to the manner in which the flight crew handled that emergency and the high number of survivors, considering that the plane landed without any conventional control. It was an amazing story. Up next, I'll be talking with Lawrence Gonzalez, Flight 232, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you about our special guest tonight. Lawrence Gonzalez has won many awards, including a couple National Magazine Awards and the Distinguished Service Award from the Society of Professional Journalists. That's a great honor, by the way. He has appeared as a speaker before groups ranging from the Santa Fe Institute to the Legg Mason Capital Management Group, the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and the Sloan School of Management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He was last with us about 7.5 years ago. Lawrence, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me back. I'm great. Thank you.
What was it, deep survival or surviving survival 7.5 years ago that we talked with you?
It was probably deep survival, and that's been certainly a perennial bestseller. And surviving survival is the sequel to deep survival.
We'll talk about that next hour. And I've got to tell you, I fly a lot, so I want to first of all get your reaction to this Malaysian Flight 370. I mean, oh, my gosh. Where is this thing?
Oh, it's a very, very, very sad story. And, of course, we don't know. The answer is we don't know. But all of the sources that I have in the National Transportation Safety Board and elsewhere seem to agree that they think that there was some sort of onboard fire. Hmm. And that this crew was trying heroically to get back to the airport and simply was overcome by the smoke. And once that happened, of course, what you see on the radar track is the plane just flew in a straight line for about 6 or 7 hours, and that happened to be the amount of fuel they had left on board.
Yeah.
And so they flew to exhaustion and then went into the sea.
Do you think maybe the fire occurred in the cockpit, and in the waning, dying moments of the crew, they might have flipped it to automatic pilot and, you know, they succumbed?
They would have been on autopilot anyway, because that's the normal...
That's standard?
Procedure. Yeah. Autopilot is standard procedure.
Okay.
But in fighting the fire, they don't have many resources. When you're up in the air and you have a fire, it's a terrible, terrible emergency. And we don't know this. Like I say, this is speculation. But the experts trying to put the pieces of information together that we do have said to me, I can't think of anything other than a fire, because that's what would incapacitate a crew.
It's a bizarre story. We've had all kinds of theories, Lawrence, on the program from, it was hijacked, it was crashed, it's on land somewhere. It's one of the most baffling cases I've seen in my career.
Yeah, and mine too. I've been studying aviation accidents since 1972, and I've never seen anything like this.
I fly a lot. Probably 40 flights a year now. And when I was reading Flight 232, I just tried to imagine myself as a passenger in this plane. It loses its engine control in the back. And gosh, what a disaster. Anyways, what drew you to this crash? I remember this episode when this thing occurred back in 89.
Yeah. I'll tell you. What drew me to it was it is simply the most intense human drama I've ever come across in my career. 40 years of being a journalist and a writer, I've never seen anything so intense. and uplifting in a surprising way than this. It's just human heroism, the people caring for one another when they don't even know each other, people giving their lives for others. It's just an amazing human story.
From the flight from Denver to Chicago with the crash in Sioux City, Iowa, at what point into the flight, Lawrence, did they have that problem with that rear engine?
It was about an hour in. They were having lunch. It was a beautiful summer day, July, just like right now.
Cruising along.
Cruising along, perfectly fine. The flight attendants are serving lunch. People are eating this picnic lunch that United had that day. And they're watching a video of the Kentucky Derby, and everything's good. And there's this huge explosion, just a sickening explosion that shakes the plane from front to back. And everybody just goes white.
Yeah.
And you're up there, and as I take you through this story, people are just saying, oh, my God, you know, I'm not a very good wife. I'm not a very good mother. I'm going to change my ways. Please, God, get me down from here. And just bargaining with God and, you know, reviewing their lives and thinking, how will this end? And it did, as you say, it lost this the catastrophic failure of this engine. Threw all sorts of metal parts out as it broke apart and cut the hydraulic lines and basically reduced this plane to something with no steering at all.
Okay, I want you to put all of us listening to you tonight, Lawrence, on that plane. We're passengers on that plane now. We've heard the explosion. They've lost hydraulics. What's happening? Is the pilot talking to us?
Yeah, the first thing that happens is there's this huge explosion. Everybody freezes. And then a voice comes on the intercom, the public address system, and says, that's okay, don't worry, we just lost an engine, it's okay, we have two other engines, we're going to fly on to Chicago. And so there's this kind of sigh of relief at first. And in fact, in the back of the plane, the flight attendants go ahead and start serving drinks. And the mayor of Palmer, Colorado, is sitting there near the back of the plane, and a flight attendant named Susan White comes up to him with her cart and says, can I get you something? And he says, give me a vodka. And she starts to get him the vodka, and he says, make it a double. And then he looks at her and sees she's quaking. She's just pale. She's shaking. She's white as a sheet. And he says, you know, I think you really ought to have one of these. And they kind of laugh together. And as she's trying to pull the drink out for him, she's shaking so bad she just scatters the little bottles all over the floor. And now she's down on her knees, crawling around on the floor trying to pick up these bottles, and he's watching. And the plane is just rolling over to the right, and it's rolling and it's rolling. And the people are looking out the window seeing green instead of the blue sky, and they're thinking, oh, my God, what is this plane doing? Up in the cockpit, meanwhile, the pilot, the captain, is looking at this, saying, what's happening, trying to turn the plane to the left to bring this right wing up, and it's not happening.
Uh-huh.
It's not coming up. It's not responding to his control. So what he does, instinctively, there's two engines left, mind you, one on the right wing, one on the left wing.
And these are the two main engines, right?
Yeah, right. And the one in the tail has exploded, so it's no good. So he gooses the one on the right. He gives it full throttle, full thrust, and he reduces the one on the left back to idle. And all of a sudden, the right wing starts to come back up again, slowly just drifting up, and the plane comes to level again. Now they've averted the immediate disaster, which is the plane was going to roll over.
It would have flipped. It would have been like that Denzel Washington movie, Flight,
yep.
I think.
Okay. Yep. Would have gone straight over, and Captain Al Haynes stopped that from happening by using the two engines to correct it. Now he's in big trouble, you know, because he basically has no control except for these two engines, you know, modulating the thrust left and right.
And do we know that on the plane, that he's in trouble?
No, most people don't understand what's going on. They can tell something weird is happening because they're feeling it, and they're seeing the green earth instead of the blue sky.
Yeah.
There are one or two people on board. There was a fighter pilot on board who could see this happening and knew what was going on and was scared to death, frankly.
And wasn't there a DC-10 instructor out there, too?
Yes. Yeah, so up in first class, there's a DC-10 instructor named Dennis Fitch, and he's coming home for the weekend from Denver. He's been out there teaching DC-10 pilots, and he's watching this happen, and he's thinking, whoa, what's going on here? Something really weird is happening. You know, they've said we've lost an engine, but this doesn't seem like a normal engine out kind of situation. So he grabs the flight attendant, Jan Murray, up in first class, and he says, listen, if they need any help up there, tell them I'm an instructor, and I'll come up. So she comes back a minute later and says, yeah, come on up. They want you up there. And Dennis Fitch goes on up, and the cockpit door opens, and he describes it as, he said, he looked in there, and he could see these two pilots hauling back on the controls and trying to turn left, and the plane's turning right, and he said, oh, my God, I'm going to die today. He said, you know, he had just said goodbye to his wife on the phone that day, and it was his high school sweetheart. He was 46 years old, and he said, I'm going to die today.
Mm.
This is the end of this flight.
So the plane continues.
Yep.
An hour into the flight, this is happening. At what point do they make this decision, we got to land, and here's Sioux City, here we go?
Well, they were out there mid-Iowa on their way to Chicago. So they were east of Sioux City on their way to Chicago when this engine blew, and they didn't have much control. So if you look in the book, Flight 232, there's a map of their radar track, and you can see they turn right. And it's a big 20-mile turn. They're trying to stop turning, but they can't stop the plane.
They could have gone on to St. Louis, too, right? I think it's in that course.
It's a little farther.
Right.
But they're out there in the middle of the cornfields, and there's no big airports to land a plane of this size. And so they make the decision that the nearest airport is Sioux City, and they're going to try to get there. But the truth is that if you look at this radar track, you can see they really weren't controlling the plane. They were just keeping it from rolling over on its back. So it goes around and around and around in these big looping right turns, descending all the way. And I'll tell you, I talked to the captain, and I said, Al, how did you get that plane to that runway? I mean, you roll out, and you're right pointed at that runway. How did you do that? And he said, I have no idea.
God.
he thought he was going to roll out. He told me he thought he was going to roll out and land in a cornfield. And by God's luck, you know, he came to the runway. So it's a really harrowing tale.
So here he goes in for the landing. Does he have his landing gear down? That goes down? Okay.
Yeah, they had a discussion about the landing gear. Now, they have no hydraulics. So the landing gear usually are put down by hydraulic power. However, the landing gear are big, heavy trucks of wheels, and they are designed so that if you open the doors, that they'll just fall down and lock in place. So that's what they did. They opened the doors.
And
the
that,
doors
are that locked. Worked. Okay.
Yeah, so they got the gear down. Now they're committed, because once the gear's down, you've got a lot of drag out there from the airstream.
Right. That's right.
And they're committed. They're going to go down, wherever they go down. And they're telling the control tower, they're saying, like, you know, we're going to ditch out here somewhere. We don't know where, because they're barely able to control the plane. And by chance, as I say, through a guess and a by God, they come out and they're pointed right at the runway.
So
now, mind you, George, this runway that they're pointed at is a 1940s World War II training runway for bombers.
It's not that long.
And it's not that long, and it's closed. Not only is it closed, but it has a bunch of fire engines on it.
They
staged the fire engines on that runway because the runway is closed.
Now, is there anybody in a tower somewhere?
Yeah, there's the control tower, and the control tower sees this plane come up over the bluffs at Sioux City, and he's aimed at this old World War II runway with all the fire engines on it. And the guy says, you know, well, okay, that'll work.
Yeah.
You know, we're gonna get the equipment off the runway now. So all of a sudden there's this scramble to get all these fire engines off the runway. And this guy's on 1.5 mile final with a DC-10.
Oh, my God. And so they at least had enough people to get these trucks out of the way?
Yeah, well, they had staged the emergency equipment on the field because when the engine blew about 44 minutes before the crash, when the engine blew, they radioed in and said, we have an emergency.
Okay, so they were ready.
So they knew, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people on the field waiting to respond to this. And so they're watching this happen. Now, picture this. Sioux City Airport is an Air National Guard base, and they've got these fighter planes that they train with, and they're flying around and, you know, doing their practice bomb runs and all that. These guys are out there when this emergency happens, and they call them up and say, hey, you guys better get back in here because we got an emergency going. So you've got fighter planes landing, and you've got this DC-10 coming in.
Oh, my God.
And the fighter planes land just ahead of the DC-10, and then they can't taxi into the ramp because the DC-10's on short final. So they're sitting out there looking at this DC-10 coming in, thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, is this guy going to kill us, going to hit us?
Yeah, and this plane is coming in at faster than most landings, right?
Right. So he doesn't have hydraulics, so he cannot put his flaps down. Therefore, instead of going about 130 knots, he's going 250 knots.
Ugh. But the brakes will work, or maybe not.
No, no brakes.
No brakes.
No brakes, no flaps, no nothing.
No nothing.
No nose wheel steering.
Okay, so I assume he says, assume the crash position, everybody, right?
Yep. Right, so the people inside are seeing this happen, and as they approach the airport, they're looking up through their little windows, and they're seeing this screaming streak of green going by, thinking, whoa, this is way too fast. This is not normal. What's going to happen? And they're talking to one another and praying. Some people have their Bibles out. They're holding hands. Women are putting their driver's licenses down into their bras so that they can be identified after the crash. I mean, it's just a surreal
thing. This gets emotional. Jeez,
yeah.
Lawrence.
It's very emotional. And in interviewing these people, I tell you, these people would break down and cry in the middle of the interviews. And we would just sit there and cry together for a while and before they could go on.
So the plane lands, it hits, but then it falls apart, doesn't it?
So what happens is they're steadying this plane. Dennis Fitch is on the throttles, and he's trying to keep the plane level. And if you watch the video, if you go to my website, flight232.com, you can watch this video while we're talking. And you can see this plane come in. It looks pretty level. And as it comes close to the ground, the right wing drops for whatever reason, and we really don't know. But the right wing drops, and it hits the concrete.
Bang. Yeah.
As it hits, a couple of things happen. The wing breaks. About 10,000 pounds of fuel blows out into the air and ignites. The tail snaps off. The whole tail of the aircraft snaps off and goes rocketing down the runway at about 250 miles an hour.
Now, was there anybody back there sitting?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, with people in it, this tail. And you can see the tail scraping along the runway. And I interviewed the people in that tail.
You mean some of them got out alive?
Yep, that's correct. Quite a number of them. Got out alive, and I interviewed 10 of them, and they're going to be in Sioux City for the weekend of the 25th anniversary, and I'm going to be with them. So this wing breaks, but then the right wing engine breaks off, but the left wing is still flying. So you've got this plane going 250 miles an hour, left wing still flying. It lifts up, and you can watch this in the video. Lifts up onto its nose, it's pirouetting around on its nose, and it bounces on its nose, if you can believe that.
Oh, my gosh.
And you can see in the photographs that are in the book, Flight 232, you can see where there's a black trail where the fireball is burning, and then there's nothing. There's no scar on the ground because the plane has actually bounced up in the air on its nose. While it's bouncing on the nose, it scrapes the cockpit off, and the cockpit goes flying down the runway. And then it bounces again, and it crushes first class section, and first class breaks off and goes skidding along.
Hold on for a second, Lawrence. We're going to come back in a moment. What a tragedy. But through this tragedy, there's this incredible story of survival. We're going to talk about that later on as well. And welcome back, Flight 232 with Lawrence Gonzalez. Now listen to these statistics of the 296 people on board. 111, as I mentioned earlier, died in that crash. Most were killed by injuries sustained in the multiple impacts, but 35 people in the middle fuselage section directly above the fuel tanks died from smoke inhalation in the post-crash fire. Of those, 24 had no traumatic blunt force injuries. Now, the majority of the 185 survivors were seated behind first class and ahead of the wings. I guess it was not to be sitting in first class. That was not the right spot, was it, Lawrence?
No, it was a bad place to be. And as I mentioned earlier, the plane bounced on its nose, and during one of those bounces, it crushed first class. First class was also engulfed in a fireball, and so there was a lot of trauma in first class.
Oh, my gosh. Slow deaths or fast?
What's that?
Are those deaths, are they fast or slow?
Oh, gosh. You know, it was all over the place. I'll tell you, the people you mentioned who died of smoke inhalation, there was an area of the plane behind the wing, coach cabin, where the plane actually wound up on its back. And the ceiling crushed in, and some people were trapped in their seats by the crushed ceiling. So they were alive, but they couldn't get out, and they were killed by the smoke, and that could not have been...
Horrible way to die.
Yeah, I mean, it was terrible. And in first class, it's a very interesting thing, because I interviewed one man. He was seated in the second row of first class, right up front, and... when the plane hit, his seatbelt popped, and he said he didn't know how that happened, but all of a sudden he was free in his seat, and he was kind of floating above the seat, and then the plane disintegrated in front of him. He actually watched it disintegrate, and he went flying through the air just like the human cannonball, free of the airplane. The airplane's going a different direction. He's going off into the air like Superman. And he actually, his feet went through the fireball as he was flying. And he was thinking, you know, my gosh, if I go through that fireball, I'm a dead man. And his feet went through the fireball, and he flew hundreds of yards and landed in the corn.
Huh. A lot of people were in the cornfield. They couldn't even find their way out. They had to get help, right?
Well, when the plane finally came to rest, after it did this pirouette on its nose, went upside down and slewed into the corn, it was actually sliding along the ground, cutting the corn. So when it came to rest, first class is gone, remember? The cockpit's gone. So the coach cabin is open, and it's jammed up in there in this corn. And these people come forward from first class. They've survived. They're hanging upside down in their seat belts. The plane's on fire. They pop their seat belts. They fall on their heads. They crawl out toward this. And then all of a sudden, they find they're in the corn. They're like in a cornfield. The corn is 9 feet tall. It's above their heads.
Yeah, they have no idea where they are.
Yeah, and many of them, mind you, said, oh, my God, I'm dead. I'm dead. This is heaven.
You're right. You would
and they
think
start
that.
Running. They start running down the cornfield, and all they see is green, and around them everything is green, and above them the sky is blue, and it's a beautiful day, and it's warm, and it's moist, and the ground is muddy, and they're running, and they're losing their shoes because it's so muddy, thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm in heaven. This is the end.
How strange.
You know? And then they come out the other end of the corn. These cornfields are very
big. Then they think they're in hell.
And, well, at the other end, they come out, and it's just a clearing, and there's, like, antenna towers with, you know, radio relay towers. And there's
They couldn't hear the screaming and things from the plane, I guess.
Not at that point. And then one of them just described to me coming out of the corn and going up on a little rise of the land and looking back and seeing the black smoke and smelling the smell of burning bodies.
Wasn't there a flight attendant who is now championing seat belts for children, keeping them in seats?
Yes. Jan Brown was the chief flight attendant on that flight. She was a very experienced flight attendant and is a good friend of mine now. She was actually John F. Kennedy's stewardess on his family plane.
Oh, my gosh.
When she was 21 years old, yes. And so she's got a lot of experience, and she looked out that day onto her congregation there and realized there were all these lap children who didn't have their own seats.
Oh.
And she thought, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to these babies? We have nowhere to put them. And indeed, some of those children died because the mothers can't hold on to them. In the forces of a crash, the child goes flying.
And in some cases, the mother survived?
Yes. There was one case, a little boy named Evan, a toddler, 2 years old, and his mother, Sylvia Sow, tried to hold him and could not. And she saw, during the crash, she saw him fly out of her hands and go up in the air and travel toward the back of the plane, and she never saw her baby again.
Oh, she's got to live with that for the rest of her life.
Yes, and Jen Brown has to live with it for the rest of her life because Jen is the one who helped her to, you know, this woman was saying, what do I do with my baby? What do I do with my baby? And Jen Brown said, well, we're going to put your baby on the floor. We're going to cushion him with pillows, and you just hold him there, and it's going to all be all right. Well, it wasn't all right.
No, it wasn't. and you know, I think the same thing, Lawrence, when I'm flying and a mother has got a little baby on her lap, and even the child looks like it could be big enough to be strapped in, but they're not.
Yeah.
And so I guess it hasn't been turned into a law yet, has it?
No, it's still okay legally to take a child on a plane without a seat. I would never do that. I mean, it's just unthinkable to do that any more than you would put a child in a car without a car seat. It's essential to have the child strapped in just like everybody else. And I don't, you know, it's mysterious why the FAA refuses to make this a law, but Jan has made it her life's work to try to get this law changed, and I support her every step of the way. There was another boy, 2 years old, same situation, except his mother had bought him a seat, and he was strapped in next to her. When the crash happened, everything came to a stop, and Aaron Badis is his name. Little Aaron was in his seat and was fine, and he got out of the plane, and he's now an adult, and he will be at Sioux City, Iowa on July 19th.
Do they remember this episode, the little kids?
No, not, you know, Aaron, I don't think remembers very much of it. He has some vague memories of it, but not really. Now, there were a lot of children on this flight, and I talked to quite a number of them, and many of them do remember a lot. And their stories are really harrowing. To be a 9-year-old boy traveling alone on a flight and have it be essentially your first flight, your first experience of flight.
And maybe your last for a long time.
And it crashes. Well, one boy in the back of the plane, whose name was Israel Brownstein, 9 years old, traveling alone, first flight. He had traveled as an infant, but he didn't remember it. But this is the first flight he had that he remembered. And he was so scared when the engine blew up. He couldn't do anything for himself. He was rigid with fear. He was just quaking, and this businessman sitting next to him was saying, you've got to brace, you've got to grab your ankles, and he couldn't do anything. And the businessman, whose name was Richard Howard Sudlow, grabbed him and forced him down and put his body over the boy and protected him, and it cost him his life. This businessman lost his life protecting this boy. And the boy is an adult now. I interviewed him at my home. He's in his 30s. He's a psychologist and owes his life to this businessman.
Next hour, we'll talk about your work, Surviving Survival, and what people have to go through when they've gone through some traumatic episode, whether it's a car crash, you name it. Tell us the story, Lawrence, of Sabrina Lee Michelson.
Sabrina was a lap child, like we've been talking about. She was an infant, 11 months old, almost a year old. And her mom, Lori Michelson, was holding her. And just like Sylvia Sow with Evan, she couldn't hold her. The little baby, you know, the apparent weight was too great during the crash, and the baby went flying. And Lori, the mom, and the father searched for this baby in the aftermath of the crash, but the plane was on fire. The fuselage was filling with smoke, and they were driven out of the fuselage without their baby.
They had lost their baby. They figured the baby was dead.
And they figured, oh, my God, we've lost our baby. Our baby's dead. There was a man on board named Jerry Schimmel who had been watching Sylvia Sow with Evan, little Evan, who went flying. And he was thinking before the crash, I'm going to help this lady. I'm going to try to help her get out. And in fact, in the aftermath of the crash, he had seen Sylvia trying to go to the back, and he had said, no, you can't go back there. You'll die. You have to get out. You have to get out. And Sylvia said, but my baby's back there. And he said, I'll find your baby for you. Well, Sylvia went out, but Jerry didn't find the baby. And he got out of the plane himself without the baby and heard crying. Just as he stepped out of the plane, he heard a baby crying. And he went back into the burning plane, flames, smoke. He closes his eyes because he can't see. He holds his breath because he can't breathe. But he's still hearing this crying, and he's saying, please keep crying, please keep crying. And he goes and follows this crying, finally gets to what's an overhead bin beneath his feet because the plane's upside down, reaches in, grabs this baby, clutches the baby to him, and runs outside.
The baby's in the overhead bin upside down?
Overhead, right, a baby in an overhead bin, and he grabs the baby and runs out, and he looks at the baby, and it's not Evan. It's this little girl. He's got this little girl. He doesn't know where she came from. She's perfectly okay. She's got a little mark on her.
Doesn't know who the parents are at that point, right?
Has no idea who this baby is. He's just somehow gotten a baby out. So he runs through the cornfield just like everybody else is doing. He's clutching this baby, and he gets to the end of the cornfield, and there's a little rise in the land, like I mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's some people gathered there, and he sees this lady and runs up to her and says, here, take this baby. I just got this baby. And he feels like he has to go back to the plane for some reason, and he can't think why it is. But obviously, in my mind, it's Evan who's still missing.
Yeah.
But he gives this little girl baby to a lady, and the lady's name is Margot Crane. And she just holds the baby. The baby's not even crying, not hurt. And this man comes out of the cornfield and sees her and goes, oh, my God, my baby. You've got my baby. And finally, Sabrina Lee Michelson is reunited with her family on this little rise in the land out in the middle of this cornfield in Iowa. Now, Sabrina Lee Michelson grew up all her life. Her parents sent pictures to the man who saved her.
You would think that this was a happy ending. But it's not, is it?
Right. So she grows up with the knowledge that she's the baby who got saved from the plane. And there's some sort of emotional residue in her little infant brain, you know, of this catastrophe. And every year on her birthday, they send cards to Jerry Schemmel. They send pictures to Jerry Schemmel. And she's the little girl from the plane. And, in fact, even in seventh grade, she wrote something online in a chat room saying, I'm the baby from the plane. You know, I'm the one who was saved from the plane. And I don't know what caused this, but just a few days shy of her 20th birthday, Sabrina Lee Michelson took her own life and ended the story. And we can't know why. We really can't know why.
We don't know what happened.
We don't know what happened. And her family wants to be left alone, which I respect. And yet I can't help thinking that somehow this crash loomed over her life for all those years.
Was that the impetus for Surviving Survival and Deep Survival?
Well, Deep Survival came first, and I think the impetus for Deep Survival really was my own father's story, which I may have told you in the past.
Yeah.
It's a story that's told in Deep Survival. My father was a combat pilot in World War II, and he was shot down over Germany. And his plane was blown apart, and he fell in a little piece of this plane that was a fragment, like a bathtub, practically. He couldn't get his parachute on. He fell 27,000 feet with no parachute.
Oh, my God.
And he survived it. And we don't really know why. I mean, there's speculation.
What did he land on, a huge ball of cotton?
Well, you know, it's funny. It had just snowed. This was outside of Dusseldorf on a farm in Germany. It had just snowed, so there was deep snow, and he landed on a railroad embankment, so there was a slope. And his thinking was always that somehow he had hit just right and gone down this slope in the snow.
It wasn't a direct impact.
It wasn't a direct impact, right. But 27,000 feet, so he survives that, and the Nazis take him prisoner and put him in prison camp. He went in weighing 165 pounds and came out weighing about 110 because they were running out of food. This was near the end of the war. But he was liberated, and he came back, and he had a family, and he had a career, and I grew up in the shadow of this man, and hearing these stories and thinking, why does one person survive and another, you know, doesn't? And it, I think, started my interest in survival.
Well, and that's an interesting question you bring up, Lawrence. It's almost like a paradox where that flight, for example, 232, those who survived are probably saying, why?
Yeah.
What's my purpose? Why was I saved? If you believe in a God, you think, you know, do I have a mission? Is there some reason I'm supposed to be here? But then you look at those who passed, the 111 people who died, were they merely in the wrong place at the wrong time?
And, you know, the way that I've structured the book, Flight 232, is it begins with the chaplain of the 185th Air National Guard, and he's taking his kids to a movie. And you see this chaplain look up, and he sees the plane going over, and then he follows it, and he sees the fireball and starts running to the airport. Well, the chaplain appears throughout the book in various roles. And then in the end of the book, the chaplain appears, and he actually gives a sermon on this subject. And it was really interesting because I was with him, and I was interviewing him, and suddenly he broke into this kind of sermon, and it was perfect. I thought, oh, my gosh, thank you for writing the end of my book for me. Because he just sums this up. He says, no, God did not want that little five-year-old to die. God did not make this happen. He said, I'm a United Methodist, and we believe in human free will. We believe people are imperfect, and they have free will, and they can do stupid things. And in this case, they built a machine that broke.
Yeah.
You know, it's not God wants this child to die.
No, I don't believe that either. I don't think God picks and chooses.
Right. And God gives you the free will to make a machine, and you make a machine that's imperfect, and it breaks, and people get hurt.
And they have since changed the DC-10 and other jets because of this mishap, haven't they?
Yes. Well, the DC-10 does not actually carry passengers anymore.
Oh, FedEx, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's been retired pretty much.
Is it like just a cargo plane?
Yeah, the FedEx uses them, and there's cargo planes, but in fact, the DC-10 did have a flaw in it, and it wasn't just that engine. It was just a badly designed plane.
Wasn't there a Chicago DC-10 that crashed, too?
I was supposed to be on that one.
Oh, my God.
I don't know if you heard this story. 1979, my first book was coming out, and I was going with my colleagues to the book fair in Los Angeles, and we were all going to go there for promotional purposes. And I found out it was a DC-10, and I said, wait a minute, I don't like DC-10s. I had been, as I said earlier, studying airline accidents since the early 70s, and I had become very suspicious of the DC-10.
Yeah, there was something wrong with that plane.
It just crashed and crashed and crashed, and I didn't like it. And I said, you know what, I'm going to get a different flight or something because I don't like DC-10s. And so I didn't get on that plane, and my colleagues did get on that plane. The flight, American Airlines Flight 191 out of Chicago, May 25th, 1979, the flight lasted 31 seconds.
I interviewed David Booth, who had been telling the FAA way before that event that there was going to be a crash of a DC-10.
Really?
And he would try to talk to them, and he'd try to convince them. Well, they finally believed him after the fact.
Yeah, it was very sad. I mean, it was so predictable. And, well, you know, I missed that one by a hair. But I never flew DC-10s after that.
Lawrence, we're going to take this break. We're going to come back. You're with me for two more hours. We're going to talk a little bit about surviving survival. But I also want you to address, what have we learned since Flight 232? And then we'll get into your other work, Surviving Survival, The Art and Science of Resilience. I mean, you go through a horrible situation, a car crash, and you live. What happens to your life afterward? I had a car crash when I was 18 years old, going to college. I'll tell you about that, too, when I come back.